When energy costs jump, everyone feels it. At the Bowser, on the power bill, and across the economy.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. On ABC Business Daily's Fuelcast, we break down the latest in fuel, energy, and the forces driving prices.
It's a quick, clear update on what's moving, why it matters, and what it can mean for your wallet and the wider economy.
Find Fuelcast in the ABC Business Daily feed, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
To find out who was at Irma's house when she was killed, police built a fake criminal network around one of the suspects, a scheme known as a Mr. Big. But as a lot of you have pointed out, it is a controversial method. So we're going to find out why. I'm Stephen Stockwell. This is episode 12 of The Case of the Two Intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
We have never made an episode based around a single question, but we had so many questions, so many emails asking us about the undercover operation the AFP built around Steve Fabrizi, one of the men convicted of the manslaughter of Irma Palasik. So many questions that we had to dive deeper. To do this, we've invited Alicia Bridges, who reported the Unravel season Mr. Big to The Case Of. Alicia, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Stocky.
And we've also got ABC court reporter, the indomitable Elizabeth Byrne, with us as well. Liz has covered this case for many years, has sat through the trial. Liz, thank you for joining us as well.
Hi, Stocky.
I'm so pleased that we've got both of you with us for this episode because, yeah, as I mentioned, we had so many questions during this trial of whether or not the undercover operation that police built around Steve Fabrizi was a Mr. Big. Helen, Kat, Luke, Anya, Ian... You know, I'm just going to skip the other 30 names of the people who got in touch. But yeah, so many people wondering, is this a Mr. Big? Stocky, why aren't you talking about the Unravel season that this was made about? All of these questions. Alicia, this is why we have you here. Was this a Mr. Big?
Yeah, I mean, it has all the hallmarks of a Mr. Big sting. So there are multiple names that the police use to describe these types of operations, and they do differ slightly in some cases. You know, they call them the Big Boss operation, the scenario technique, which actually makes it sort of harder to find them too when you're looking back historically that they have all these different names. But in terms of how it operates, the strategy, the playbook, this does sound like a Mr. Big sting.
Yeah, so these are operations where police bring someone into like a fake criminal network. So they're investigating someone for a crime. They want a bit more information. So they, you know, they kind of build this undercover operation around them. They think they're talking to criminals. They're actually talking to undercover police this whole time. And Alicia, as well as the question of, you know, was this a Mr. Big? A lot of people asked us, you know, are you going to talk about some of the concerns with this approach? Because there are some pretty significant, you know, concerns and questions about how this is used, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the sort of overarching concern is that this technique carries a higher risk of false or unreliable confessions and, as a result, potentially wrongful convictions. And that's because of the way the sting is run. They operate over a very long time. They're often focused on a person who... maybe they're lonely. It's a person who's looking for community. You know, there are a lot of people who this sting just wouldn't work on them. But the concerns relate to potentially targeting vulnerable people or people who are lonely or need community. Also that the suspect usually gets paid for the work that they do. And that could be sort of an inducement or a reason that someone might confess when they didn't commit the crime. These people often think that they're going to get a lot of money if they stay in the gang, or they're led to believe that that might happen. They might falsely confess because they're intimidated by the crime boss. So there's this, there's concerns about pressure and that you could have a coerced confession or a confession that came as a result of the pressure of being in a room with someone that you think is the boss of a criminal organisation.
Yeah, Mr. Big, right? That's where the name comes from. These are all things we couldn't talk about during the trial. And people listening also flagged some other concerns with this process. Can you give us some more?
There are concerns about the fact that with these operations being very expensive, that could be an incentive for the police to pursue a charge, even when, you know, maybe they've gotten, you know, 7 months into the sting, and then, you know, they don't hear what they want to hear. I mean, not to say that this is something that's happened, but that is one of the concerns. And also that these confessions carry a lot of weight with the jury. And yes, the confession is recorded, but the undercovers may have spent a lot of time with that person behind the scenes, hundreds of hours, and the jury doesn't get to hear all of those interactions. So what has happened in the lead up? And there are a lot of cases too that we will never know about, because we only hear about the cases where a charge has been laid. So what happens in those other instances where we don't get to hear about the Mr. Big operation?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Alicia, you looked at the case involving Glenn Weaven. You know, we've been following this. It's been used in the murder trial of Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ocone. Both have been found guilty of manslaughter, as that's concluded. But something I'm really interested in unpacking in this is the differences in how this is used. It's actually, you know, this is a much more nuanced conversation than I was actually kind of expecting that we would get into. Liz, in the trial that we've just been covering, the case of the two intruders, how was this process and how was this tactic used?
Well, it wasn't used against both people who were accused. It was used only against Steve Fabrizi, who police had identified through a link to DNA found at the murder scene. So they drew him into a fake criminal syndicate. A couple of times he met the head of the syndicate, UCO Danny, who we sort of met in court. We couldn't see him, of course, because he can't be identified. But he was drawn in to this syndicate. He was told that his DNA had been found at a murder scene in Canberra. First of all, he denied it, then he admitted it, then he said he was there with another guy, gave a little bit of detail about who that might have been, although he didn't really give him up at that point. He just sort of said his name was Joe and didn't spell his surname correctly. And so the police did get some way with this when they drew him into this fake system. And then after he'd given this partial confession to being there, he was arrested a bit later. But that had run between January 2023 and September 2023. So, you know, over many months, they drew him in, giving him work and convincing him that they were his friends.
Mm, yeah, paying him through that period as well. We heard he was paid $10,000 for some of the work that he did. Liz, one of the questions we got, as well as, is this a Mr. Big? Are you going to talk about some of the criticisms of it? And why aren't you talking about the wonderful Unravel season, Mr. Big? The other question we got, Liz, was, why haven't we described this as a Mr. Big scenario in our reporting of it? Liz, why didn't we do that during the trial of Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ocone?
Well, it was never put to the jury in those terms, and you can't report things that aren't put to the jury. So I would have possibly ended up in jail or at least contempt of court. But this is an important thing. Police don't like to call it Mr. Big because that system has been found wanting in other places. So they don't like this scenario thing to be labelled like that. And so it was never mentioned in court. And today's the first time I've been able to talk about the similarities.
Yeah, I am so relieved that I can finally talk about Alicia's season of Unravel, because I've been desperately wanting to the whole time. Listeners to the case of will know how much I love an ABC Listen plug, and I've had a great opportunity to promote some Unravel content. I haven't been able to until right now. Alicia, we have got you on because of your season on Unravel, Mr. Big. Mm-hmm. This followed the investigation of a guy called Glenn Weaven. Can you talk us through how this tactic was used in the investigation that you looked into?
Yeah, so it all began with the first interaction between the police and the suspect was a sort of fabricated competition where they went to the suspect's door. He could win some beer if he provided some information, you know, personal information. But the idea was that if he participated, that he would end up, the prize was something that would bring him to a particular place where they could sort of introduce themselves in a sort of fabricated chance meeting. And that ended up being the pub. So essentially it started there in the pub. That was his first interaction with these people, and the undercover officers sort of asked him if he wanted to take some photographs of someone, and that was the first job. And essentially from there they befriended him, they brought him into this organization, they gave him multiple jobs, which were things like, can you stand on the street and keep an eye out for this person and take a picture of them when they come outside? They're having an affair and, you know, we need a photograph of that for blackmail purposes, I think it was. And then the jobs kind of escalate. You know, he ends up carrying money, carrying guns. He sees another one of the undercover officers deliver a package to the Supreme Court with the belief that, you know, that would provide some influence in a case. And he does start to, you know, get concerned along the way. He says now that he was trying to get out of the gang as it went to the point of getting close to that confession scenario because he was under pressure. But of course, the police would say that, no, he was fully on board. And yes, of course, it ended in the final scenario with the crime boss. Prior to that, they had led Glenn to believe that there was a big job coming up and that if he participated in that job, he would have a share of the money, a big payout at the end. But shortly leading up to that, he was led to believe that the police were closing in on him in relation to the murder of Mary Cook, a woman that he knew. And so when he came into that sort of final meeting with Mr. Big, which is at Crown Casino, I believe it's been held, the final scenario has been at Crown Casino in other cases as well, multiple times. But yeah, he goes into this meeting thinking that, or he's told in the meeting that they can help him, the gang can help him get out of this situation. They can get the police off his back. He just needs to tell them the details of what happened with Mary and the details of her murder. If he tells them that, they can make the evidence go away. They can get the police off his back.
Yeah, let's take a listen. And I mean, just so you know, we've pulled a few bits of a very long conversation together. So it didn't unfold just like this, but it should give you an idea. And just a heads up, there is some strong language in this.
I'm really happy with what you've been doing, you know. You're really showing you've got some style about you. No fuss, you know.
Yeah.
You're always reliable. Every time we've wanted you on board, you know, you've been there for us. It's been no problem with money, you know. Like, you know, sometimes people get a bit overawed with the amount of money that we deal with, you know.
Mm-hmm. To me, it's not mine, so I don't look at it.
Even you know, if you're going to be a part of this, you'll be looking at 100k easy, you know, out of one job, okay?
Yeah, I want a piece of the pie.
Okay.
And I can assure you that I wouldn't let you down in any way.
Yeah.
I'm not that type of person.
That's the thing I want to talk to you about, you know. I've got to have trust in all the people that are working for me, you know, because at the end of the day, it's my ass in the sling, you know what I mean? Because in this game, right, it's not like applying for a job or it's not like working in an office Monday to Friday. I mean, in this game, if we come unstuck, then we might end up in the bin, you know? You know what I mean? I can't have any police sniffing around any of the people that are working for me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if that's going to happen, they're going to end up sniffing around me at some stage, aren't they? So you've got a bit of a problem with the coppers on your ass at the moment, all right? I've got coppers in every state that I pay good money to, and I don't do it because I like the fucking police.
Mm.
Let me tell you that right now, all right?
No,
because in this game, if we come unstuck, then we might end up in the bin, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you don't tell me what happened, how am I going to fix the fucking thing? Yep, okay, so what happened? What went wrong?
Over the neck and...
When you say the neck, what, you stab her in the neck?
Yep.
With a knife?
Yep.
So that's the undercover recording, the conversation that Mr. Big has with Glenn Weaven in Crown Casino, the same Crown Casino where the undercover recording is done with Steve Fabrizi in, you know, the case of the two intruders that Liz, you and I have just been following along. And Liz, does that conversation sound familiar to you?
Absolutely, starting with the Crown Casino, but also the sort of contours of it where they talk about trust and they discuss a big job coming up where, you know, he'd make enough money, Mr. Fabrizi would have made enough money to keep him for 50 years. But there's a problem. And then they tell him that his DNA has been found at a murder scene in Canberra. But they can help him because, of course, they've got a connection in the police force. This is, and these are all the same sorts of things that were said in the Glenweaven case. There's also a media release about offering a reward for whoever can come up with who might have been there and committed the crime. So then they say, it's all right, we can help you, but you've got to tell us the truth. And if you don't tell us the truth, we can't do anything for you. So you must tell the truth. And when he tells them various versions, like, you know, he's never been to Canberra, he starts with, and then eventually he admits that he'd gone there with another person. Mm. But while all of that's being discussed, they, to sort of put pressure on him, they tell him about somebody dying, somebody being murdered, and then they say there's an eyewitness, or there was an eyewitness, there was a man and he survived, to put more pressure on. So it's just this, the same sorts of contours where they don't reveal everything to start with, but they gradually reveal things that are actually true, but they're revealed in such a way to guide Fabrizi into telling them the truth about what happened that day, or to attempt to guide him into telling them what happened.
Listening back to Mr. Big as we were preparing for this, I just felt like I was having deja vu listening to some of the tapes, Alicia, of the recording with Glen Weaven, because it just feels exactly like, it feels almost exactly the same conversation. When you start looking at it through this lens, you realise how similar they are, which is just kind of wild. And I mean, in the case of the two intruders, we were looking at this was, you know, them trying to work out how was this guy involved in the murder of Irma Plasics, if he was involved in the murder of Irma Plasics. You know, what were police trying to get from Glen Weaven in this conversation? What were they trying to unpack?
Well, at that point, they believe that he was involved, obviously, to a point, to the extent that they felt that it was worth investing in this quite expensive, lengthy operation. So he's I don't know if this is the correct language, but he's a prime suspect in their view. And when they take him into that room, they would say that their goal is to get the truth. They just want the facts. They want to know what really happened, and they're going to ask the right questions to give this person the opportunity to confess to the murder if they did in fact do it. Critics would say that they are looking for a confession. They go in there with the idea, all the questions are guided toward that admission. So I guess it depends how you look at it. Yeah. But if you ask the police officers involved, like, they would argue that they're not guiding the conversation, they're not guiding the suspect towards a confession. They're only asking the questions to get to the truth. And it's interesting what Liz said about those similarities and the multiple versions, and how that, you know, in that case, there were multiple versions of the story. The same thing happened with Glen Weaven. He started with one version of the story. They ramped up the pressure a little bit, said, we're sick of these lies. You just need to tell us the truth. At one point, there was a break in the meeting. He went downstairs, talked to the other undercover officers at the bar, went back up, and that's when he actually told the version of the confession that was used at the trial that led to his conviction.
Yeah. Liz, how was this tactic used in the case of the two intruders? What do you think police were trying to get out of Steve Fabrizi in that meeting? Were they looking for a confession, or were they just looking for kind of more details of how he may have been involved?
Well, they told the court that they were looking for either a confession or a plausible denial. And what they got instead was a partial confession, because as we know now, Fabrizi admitted to being there, but he maintains he was only the lookout. And he said at one point he didn't really go in the house, except at the very end when Vacconi hurt himself and had to be helped out. So that he hurt himself in the bath as he was trying to get out the bathroom window where he'd come in through. That was, or at least that was the story that Steve Fabrizi told the undercover operators. So it was a fairly defined sort of goal that they had. And they were keen to point out in the witness box that it wasn't just a confession they were after.
Mm. Yeah. Alicia, what do you think of the way this tactic was used in the trial of Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ficconi? I mean, it's specific to Steve Fabrizi, but yeah, how do you think about the way it was used in this instance?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's different to a lot of the cases that I've looked at in the past that I know about. The, you know, a lot of the Mr. Big cases that I'm aware of in Australia and in Canada is a situation where, you know, the police have a suspect and they're looking for a confession, if that is indeed, you know, what happened. If the person is guilty, they want that person to confess. But they also want that person to give them details that will lead them to physical evidence to support the confession. And that doesn't always happen. Mm. In the case of Glenn Wheaton, they found a broken knife in a location where he said there would be a broken knife, but it didn't have any, you know, there wasn't any DNA to link that. But they went ahead with the prosecution and he was convicted. But so they're looking for that kind of combination of if they're a guilty person, they would like them to confess, and then they push for information that would lead them to that physical evidence, forensic evidence. But in this case, you know, they had the DNA, which is, so, you know, it's kind of a reversal. They were wanting more information to support information that they already had. So I do think it's a little bit different. Like, some of the concerns that exist around the technique may not apply in this instance that we're talking about because they already had forensic evidence they were looking for additional information that could lead them to another suspect.
Yeah. And Liz, you know, we follow this through the lens of a court, and when there are questions or concerns with any type of evidence, you've spent a lot of time in courts, defence barristers are looking for any possible window they can find to start needling through or calling some kind of evidence into doubt. You know, when this evidence was presented against Steve Fabrizi, did his lawyer, Sky Jerome, fight or challenge this in any way?
I think it's interesting, not particularly. I don't think she liked it, but I think she did a very clever thing. I think she deployed it as in her own favour. So she was able to say to the jury, because, you see, Steve Fabrizi didn't just admit to the undercover officers that he'd been there. He admitted it to the jury because he pleaded guilty to burglary at the very start of the trial. So she was able to say, look, he's told you the truth. The version that he's given you of what happened, because there was also a police interview after that, but she said the version he's given, that he was just the lookout, that you can treat that as the truth. So she kind of tried to use it. This is unusual, I think, in these cases. But obviously she didn't like the fact that it was there, but it was, she's tried to work with it. And the other thing she did with it to turn it against the police was to say to the jury in her opening that the police had developed this narrative and just wouldn't step outside it. So there were other people that might have been involved in this, other suspects, and we now know there were 331 of them, that should have been, she said, should have been considered by the police. And this was, you know, a legitimate defence for Fabrizi. So, you know, it wasn't a case of tackling this, but rather trying to make it work for her client.
Yeah, it's interesting, Liz, to hear how, yeah, Sky Jerome kind of, you know, used it. I've got actually more thoughts on how this was used that we'll get into in some of our other post-trial episodes. But Alicia, were you surprised there was no defence challenge to this through the trial?
Not really, because of that forensic evidence that they had, and also because, like, the police are allowed to use this technique. And so they would have to find, like, some use of it that didn't sort of adhere to, was outside of the parameters of what the police are allowed to do. So unless they did something that was, like, outside the boundaries of what the legal system allows in Australia, then, yeah, I mean, they've got nothing to pursue. And so, yeah, in this case, no, I'm not surprised that they didn't take that tap.
Yeah. I mean, Liz, one of the questions I have about this process is, I mean, I've learned a lot of what I, you know, think I know about courts and the law from American TV. And something I hear a lot in American TV shows about the law is this idea of entrapment. And again, I don't watch these shows too closely, so I actually don't have a clear idea of what that is. But in my mind, I have it built up as to basically a scene like the ones we've been describing here, you know, the police drawing someone in and then trying to get them to admit to something that they think they've done. I mean, is this not entrapment?
No, it's not, because entrapment is when you induce somebody to commit an actual crime and then arrest them. We had none of that, but we did find out one or two things that Fabrizi did for the syndicate, and it was jobs like picking up their sort of version of Mr. Big, UCO Danny, from the international airport and things like that. So they were very keen, though, to ensure that they said no actual crimes were committed.
I do enjoy the moments like that in court where there's clearly something they have to say as part of this, and it just gets repeated over and over again. No crimes were committed as this was unfolding, is always sort of like, you know, you kind of go, yeah, we get it. Like, you've said that 15 times now. But, you know, Alicia, as we've been talking about, you know, there are questions about how this is used. I mean, you've done a lot of work on this topic. How do the police kind of justify it?
Yeah, well, they would say that there are already their existing sort of guardrails that keep them on the right track, that make sure that these operations don't go off the rails, because there is so much that happens behind the scenes that the jury may never get to see. I mean, they spend potentially hundreds of hours with this person over a period of months. All of that may be recorded, but the jury is likely to only hear a portion of what actually happened in those interactions. So there was a High Court decision in Australia in 2014 that sort of set the rules around this, and that's what the police say, you know, make sure that we don't have false confessions or unreliable confessions and wrongful convictions from this technique. But the rules here are not as strict as they are in Canada. So in that country, they also had sort of a major Supreme Court decision that tightened up the rules around it, because there were concerns about particular cases. There had been convictions that were overturned. And so now in Canada, the police have to show to the court that there were not excessive inducements, that there was not excessive pressure. There were elements of truthfulness to the confession before it can be presented to a jury in court. So in order to be admissible, the police have to show that the confession did not break those rules, or it didn't go outside those parameters of what is allowed. So it won't even get to the point of being evidence unless they can already show to the court that, you know, they've done all the right things, that this has been done by the book, and that only then will the judge say, okay, like, this Mr. Big confession is allowed to be evidence. Mm. And our courts don't have to take those factors like incentives into account. They can take them into account, but they don't have to in the same way that they do in Canada.
Yeah, right. Liz, do you think there's kind of enough, you know, regulation, enough guardrails around the way that the system's being used in Australia?
Well, it's actually quite hard to tell, because a lot of it, because it's undercover, and a lot of it is opaque to us. And, you know, we don't know what they may or may not have done surrounding this, but it certainly seemed to me from the transcript that it was very carefully done, as if there were guidelines, and, you know, obviously they have to stick to what the High Court has said. Mm. So, look, I think it's very important that there be guidelines around something like this, because it could so easily be abused, or even just yield results that aren't true, aren't correct. I don't know. I don't think so in this case, but it is open to abuse. And if you don't have those guardrails up, then you could end up with innocent people jailed.
Yeah, the thing I kind of wonder about listening to, or just kind of reading through the transcript of how it was used in the trial of Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ficconi is, you know, as we've talked about this, we've spoken through the kind of like High Court challenges and the various legal challenges that have happened over the years. You know, I do wonder whether or not the police have that in the back of their mind. You know, we need to do this properly, because if we don't do this properly, it's going to get challenged, and we might not be able to use it anymore. I mean, is that a risk, Alicia? Is that something that they would be thinking of?
I think they absolutely would be thinking of that, because any sort of small mistake, any like slight deviation from what is allowed within the law could blow up the whole thing. And it does take a long time. It takes a lot of resources. They don't want to make a mistake. Of course, they don't want to make a mistake in any, you know, investigation into a serious crime. But I actually sat in, you know, in a case in Canada, and it was, you mentioned like that repetition of like specific things to sort of address points or to say, you know, this was not a crime, was never committed, Liz. Like, it was very similar. It was that they had to go through, there were specific scenarios that were held with the suspect just to show we didn't encourage the suspect to drink alcohol. Like, they're sort of, they had to run like more scenarios than you would think just to get to the point of being able to say, to show to the court, like, we did this just to make sure that you know, as the court, like, we didn't encourage this person to drink alcohol or sort of exploit their addiction or their vulnerability.
Mm. Liz, coming back to the case of the two intruders, how important do you think, you know, this Mr. Big investigation was in securing the manslaughter conviction for Steve Fabrizi?
Well, this was essentially a circumstantial case. And the interview with UCO Danny was part of that. It was one of the strands of the rope. But there were other strands, including that very compelling DNA evidence where Fabrizi's DNA was found on a milk bottle in the fridge. Vacconi's DNA was found on a water container in the fridge. They were the things that the police said put them at the scene and inside the house. And I think it was part of the jigsaw. If we'd had only that alone, it might have been a different story. But there were quite a few bits and pieces that brought all this together. So it was more of a tool than the smoking gun in the case.
Yeah. Alicia, you know, you're so familiar with this, you call it the Mr. Big, the Canadian method, which I do love and might now start calling it. You're also so aware of, you know, the criticisms, the shortfalls. Should it have been used in this trial?
Oh, I mean, I don't think I could say personally whether or not it should have been used. I think it has been, like, this technique has been used to solve a lot of cases and to put some objectively sort of dangerous, horrible people behind bars. So it has its place. It is a tool that the police can use. I guess the question is whether or not the legal system is strong enough to protect against the risks in this country. That's the criticism that's come up in the past and overseas. And also, you know, if the public isn't aware of how the police operate, if they don't know about the technique, they can't decide for themselves whether or not they feel that it's being operated correctly. And there, you know, historically hasn't been a lot of transparency around it. And you can understand why the police don't want this being spoken about widely, but at the same time, it is a controversial technique and, you know, there's a certain level of transparency that's expected. And the court in Australia courts have decided in Australia that the technique should not be kept a secret, that sometimes the details of the technique are not released in a particular case, but there are multiple cases where, you know, a Supreme Court judge has decided these details should be released to the public. And so that's why we're able to speak about them. And, you know, obviously it's in the public interest to do so.
Yeah. Thank you, Alicia. Thank you, Liz, as well. It's been wonderful having you both here to kind of unpack this, answer the question. As I mentioned, we got more than any other question throughout the case of the two intruders. Alicia, your work has really cut through in the case of audience because so many of them were more or less horrified that I wasn't promoting it as I normally would. So please do jump on ABC Listen. You'll find it in whatever app store you are forced to use. Search for Unravel, look up Mr. Big and get around that. It is an absolutely fantastic season. As I mentioned, I've been listening back to it to prepare for this. And there's so many things that I had just not appreciated the first time around. Coming back to it after knowing, you know, the case of the two intruders, I listened to it with a whole new light and hear so many similarities throughout it. So, Alicia, it is fantastic work. And I really appreciate you joining us for this episode as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Liz, you know this case so well, and it was wonderful to have you here and part of this conversation to give us the insight that you've got into to how this technique was used in the case of the two intruders. So thank you for being here as well.
Thanks, Stocky.
Liz and I will be back with you soon. There is lots more that we want to unpack for the case of the two intruders. There's what the jury didn't hear. There's also what we really think as well. But you will need to wait until next week for that because we've had so many emails about Ben Robert Smith that we've lined up Jamie McKinnell, the ABC Sydney crime reporter, who was at his bail application last week to explain what happened there. So we'll bring you that in your feed on Thursday. The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. This episode features Alicia Bridges and Elizabeth Byrne and was presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Whadjuk, Noongar, Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Wurundjeri people.